You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
You might not recognize William Cameron Menzies' name, but it's very likely you've seen his work, which spanned over 120 films and four decades. He created Baghdad for Douglas Fairbanks, resurrected 15th century Paris and The Beloved Rogue, and after movies transitioned to color, he set fire to Atlanta in Gone with the Wind. In his book, William Cameron Menzies, The Shape of Films to Come, film historian James Curtis chronicles the career of the man who's often referred to as Hollywood's first and greatest production designer. It's published by Pantheon, and the Film Forum will present a two-week Menzies film tribute beginning this Friday. I'm very pleased that it brings James Curtis back to our show. Good to see you.
Mm-hmm.
He was first given the title of production designer when he created the set for Gone with the Wind. Was that the first time anyone was even given that title?
Technically, no. There were a couple of people who were credited as production designers earlier, including, interestingly enough, Rudyard Kipling, who designed the props and sets for a film of one of his stories in 1921.
I didn't realize he got involved in the movies based on his film.
Well, in that particular case, he did. Kevin Brownlow pointed that out to me. But Selznick, David O. Selznick, the producer of Gone with the Wind, felt very strongly about Menzies' contribution to this film. Menzies had already figured out and had been designing films shot for shot on the drawing board, but Gone with the Wind was going to be an all-encompassing thing that involved color design, composition, and also looking after an entire art department that was there to, in effect, in a lot of ways, enable the producer to direct the film himself.
He had already been credited as the art director on films and even director of special effects, pretty much describing what he did anyway.
Yeah.
So what's the difference?
Well, in this case, though, production design went a step beyond art direction or special effects in that it dealt with everything you could say that didn't involve the actors except as graphic elements. Menzies' great advantage, I think, as an art director was that unlike most of these guys that were in films at that time designing sets, and a lot of times they're called technical directors,
Or set designers.
But in Menzies' case, he was trained as an illustrator at the Art Students League. And so he saw things, he saw the screen as something of an illustrative plane. And as a result of that, he thought about composition. He thought about what the camera is going to see. He thought about every element that got shown the audience, and he could underscore the dramatic impact in all kinds of subliminal ways.
So he didn't come to film through theater as so many other set designers had.
No.
And you write that his father told him, "I don't want the type of artist in the family who gets no farther than drawing labels for tomato cans."
His father wouldn't have understood what he was into, but I think that Menzies' peculiar genius, if you will, was that he saw this over time. It was an evolutionary process and really brought a new form of expression to the screen. There was nothing else like that in the United States up to this point.
But there were grandiose sets in early sound films.
That's true. That's true. Well, you had to go back.
Cecil B. DeMille was already doing.
We'll go back to Intolerance and the Babylonian set. But that's where you had an extravagant set, but it wasn't visualized shot by shot, so that each shot had essential elements in it and was there for a
reason. So he was doing storyboards.
Yes, he was doing storyboards. He called them continuity boards, but he essentially showed the American screen, especially Hollywood, how to visualize, pre-visualize a film on paper.
And some of these things were huge, weren't they?
Yeah. Yes.
For Alice in Wonderland in 1933, you point out his scene-by-scene illustrations turned into a packet as big as a 3 inches thick, 642 illustrations. It weighed 6.5 pounds.
That's correct.
Do we have most of those books now?
Yes,
I have. Stored somewhere?
I have one, as a matter of fact, and the original drawings are still with his family. He was trying to come up with a composite script that addressed the graphic needs of the film as much as it did the dialogue and the actors' needs. And he found out ultimately it was impractical because no actor was going to carry around a script that was 6.5 pounds heavy.
But many directors prefer to do their own storyboards.
Some of them. Back in those days, directors in a lot of cases did not have eyes the way they do today. George Cukor famously did not have a good eye. Sam Wood, who Menzies worked with a lot, did not have a good eye. And they were happy to get that kind of help, if you will.
to some degree, he was telling them where to move the camera and when to cut.
That's right, which no director would allow today, but back in the day, that did happen.
Didn't that also cut down on improvisation?
It could, to some degree. It kind of locked the actors and the director into a particular positioning, limited their movement to some degree. There were drawbacks to what he did, but at the same time, as we know, Hitchcock worked that way too, and it is in some ways a purer form of cinema than you would acquire yesterday. Otherwise, I think.
Now, he was creating sets that, to some degree, drew upon our fantasies of
That's
places.
True. That's true.
Did he go to Baghdad before he did The Thief of Baghdad?
No, he had a lot of reference books, and he would use those as a jumping off point for the film Tempest, for instance, which we're running Friday. He very much admitted that he was over-Russianizing Russia. He would take what was in these books and then just let his imagination run riot.
So he also created the canals of Venice.
That's right.
The archways of Baghdad. He did British India. He did Mexico. Mm-hmm. And all just from books?
He was a showman. He really was.
Directors must have liked this, or were certain directors more likely to be drawn to his sensibility than others?
Yeah, I think Sam Wood, for instance, who was conscious enough of his own limitations to embrace Menzies and know that he got a better film when he worked with Menzies. Other directors would use him to puzzle out problems. Hitchcock used him on Foreign Correspondent, for instance, but they had specific scenes that were problematical, and Menzies would work with him for specific sequences. The same is true of Frank Capra.
Now, in the case of Foreign Correspondent, there's this very famous scene that takes place in an airplane mm-hmm. that is shot down mm-hmm. and winds up crashing mm-hmm. Into the water. And I'd always heard about it as an example of Hitchcock's genius, because what he had done is he had the cockpit windows made out of Chinese paper, and then he rear projected the plane going down mm-hmm. onto the paper, and then when it hit the water, he just flooded it and the paper dissolved, so it just looks like they are going into the water. But was that all Hitchcock, or
no, was
that Menzies?
It was Menzies. Menzies did it in another film 10 years earlier. That's why we know it was his. But the idea of
just a brilliant thing.
Crashing a plane and you see all the action from inside the cockpit. That's pure Menzies.
And so Hitchcock shouldn't have gotten credit for Foreign Correspondent?
Well, I won't say that, but Menzies does have a credit on the film. Menzies always said that it was a rather tense, unpleasant relationship with Hitchcock, and he said the big problem with doing this sort of work is that the director thinks you're trying to tell him how to direct. Capra was like that also. But ultimately, Menzies was a tremendous problem solver, and they appreciated that.
You mentioned Capra. As I understand it, Menzies did the work on one of Capra's most famous films, and yet he doesn't have credit.
No, he's completely uncredited on the two Capra films he worked on. I think Capra, I've looked at the budgets on the Capra films, and I think Capra paid him out of his own pocket. And so he was consulting, if you will.
It's a Wonderful Life. What did he do on it?
Well, he came up with several openings. You know, Menzies was on that film before Capra was, because it started as a project for Cary Grant at RKO. It was called The Greatest Gift. And then they put it in Turnaround, or what was in that day the equivalent of Turnaround, and Liberty Film bought it, which was Capra's new company, and Menzies stayed with the project. Menzies earlier worked with Capra on Meet John Doe, and you can see Menzies' trademark in the big John Doe convention scene where it starts to rain and all the black umbrellas come out, and that's a direct steal from not only Foreign Correspondent, but Our Town.
Now, why didn't Menzies direct?
Well,
because it sounds to me like what he was doing was pretty much the equivalent of directing.
He wanted to direct. He pushed that in that direction for a long time, and he directed.
Hitchcock had been a set designer.
Yes, he had. Yes, he had. That's absolutely true. So they had a shared background in that respect. But Menzies ultimately got his chance to direct by himself, not with a partner, which happened in an early sound period in England in 1935. He directed Things to Come for Alexander Korda, and that's one of the two great iconic science fiction films he directed, the other one being Invaders from Mars in 1953.
weren't his storyboards for Invaders from Mars stolen before it began to be shot?
Yeah, they disappeared. I think that maybe the cleaning crew got a hold of them. They've never surfaced. But he designed sets so that...
Well, how did they continue shooting?
Well, Menzies had a way of designing a set so that they only built what would be seen by the camera. And if you moved the camera an inch in one direction or the other, you'd overshoot the set. So I think Menzies knew pretty well what he was doing without having the storyboards as kind of a security blanket.
How substantial were those sets? Because, let's say, Douglas Fairbanks and The Thief from Baghdad, he is leaping from building to building. He's doing something similar in the Zorro movies. Mm-hmm. Did he, Menzies, have to actually build something that could stand up?
Yeah, well, I think the idea with the Fairbanks films were that they knew what his range was so that he could jump effortlessly, and they would build the sets to that standard. But Menzies, the great thing of what Menzies did with Thief of Baghdad was create these oversized color paintings that put the thief in the middle of it all. That's not what they did with art direction back at the time. And so what Menzies did really was design a storybook on film.
How much work did he do on Gone with the Wind?
Oh, tremendous amounts of work. His daughter once told me that the phone would ring at 2 in the morning very often, and Selznick would be up, and he'd be called to Selznick's house to go over something. He was on that film constantly, and it was such a exhausting experience that he resisted working for Selznick again thereafter.
He didn't design Tara, but he could design Atlanta. Atlanta that's burned?
Well, he was in charge of the entire look of the film. The art director, the credited art director, Lyle Wheeler, reported to him. So, and Selznick, there are lots of memos in the Selznick papers that show that anybody who had a quibble about the physical look of the film, Menzies was the ultimate authority.
And what was the last film he worked on?
Around the World in 80 Days.
So that's pretty late.
Yeah.
Do we see his influence today in movies, or have things changed a lot?
I think you see his influence in a couple of ways. Now, every major film is storyboarded, and that comes from Menzies. I think also a lot of directors who are of the baby boomer generation, Spielberg and George Lucas, for instance, among them, I think have been influenced by Menzies over the years. Martin Scorsese is one that acknowledges as much. Invaders from Mars, the great thing about Invaders
from Mars. Tim Burton does his own storyboards.
Tim Burton does it. Tim Burton is somewhat more of a cartoonist in my mind, but I'm sure that he's consumed Menzies' products as well. I think the main thing about Invaders from Mars that was so brilliant about it was it's told from the young boy's standpoint, and the paranoia is ratcheted up accordingly, and you've seen that time and again in the Steven Spielberg films like E.T., etc.
Should I assume that these days 10 people are doing the job that he did by himself?
Yeah, multiple people, that's for sure. Today it's the director of cinematography, the art director who, if he's a senior man or woman, ends up being the production designer. But it's all a collaborative process, and less so when Menzies was doing it because he was a one-man band.
He had been fearful of losing his career after talking pictures.
That's right.
Became the norm in the 1930s. What was he afraid of? After all, what he did had nothing to do with whether there was sound.
I think the problem there was that he thought dialogue would come to dominate instead of action and instead of what he saw as beauty on the screen. And if you look at the late silent movies, they're absolutely perfect in terms of not only their design, but also the fact that they use very few title cards. Look at a film like Sunrise, for instance. Early talkies are that, very talky, very stage-bound, very static. And when he got the chance to design an early talkie, which was Bulldog Drummond, the first film that enabled audiences to hear Ronald Coleman's voice, he drew out the whole thing in advance, the first time he did that, so that they could take each individual sequence and know exactly where they were going to put the microphone, how the action was going to go, so they didn't have to work all that out on the stage.
He must have been thrilled when Technicolor came on the scene.
Yeah. Yeah, he was. Well, he did some early two-color Technicolor things, but those were individual sequences. When he went to work on Nothing Sacred, which was the great screwball comedy.
Lubitsch.
Bill Wellman.
Oh, okay.
Carol Lombard and Frederick March.
It feels Lubitsch-y.
Yeah, it does. It does. It does. There was no stock footage in three-color Technicolor, so he had to shoot everything. And he did a lot of the second unit work on that, but he had a great time with that.
The Film Forum is running a series of his films, mostly the famous ones?
Not only. There are some real rarities in there, including the opening night. Nobody has seen The Dove unless you've gone to the Library of Congress and watched it on a flatbed reader like I have.
When is that from?
That's from 1927, Norma Talmadge. And the great thing about this program on Friday night is this is the first time, I think, ever that the two features are being shown together in one program that brought William Cameron Menzies the first Academy Award ever awarded for art direction.
We have a clip from Gone with the Wind and the Atlanta Burnings on our show page if listeners want to see it again and get a real sense of just how brilliant William Cameron Menzies could be.
Mm-hmm.
And my great thanks to you, James Curtis, for coming by to talk about your book, which includes, of course, lots of pictures. William Cameron Menzies, The Shape of Films to Come. It is published by Pantheon.